This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday pitch-in, where we hear from a few different people on a few different topics. Coming up, an Indiana nonprofit dedicated to science education and communication is involved in a nationwide inventory of urban biodiversity. And you can get the whole family together to help this weekend. We'll share how. And a Notre Dame economics professor shares a new study that suggests political polarization has an effect on whether or not people comply with COVID-19 safety guidelines. We'll explore the study and hear some of the surprising results. But first, a quick look at the big state headlines from this past week with our fearless digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
I'm doing okay. You're in the studio. You and our technical director, right?
Yes.
Or are you? Okay. All right. So what happened this week? We got new numbers, of course, as we do every single day. What are we at?
Yeah, so as of 11:59 p.m., we have more than 13,500 confirmed cases, 741 deaths, and more than 75,500 tests that have been run in the state. So to kind of compare where we were last week, we were just over 10,000 confirmed cases. We had 519 deaths and more than 54,000 tests. Anecdotally, we've been jumping about 200 deaths and some change every week for about the last three, and we actually hit 700 deaths on Thursday. But kind of what's becoming more interesting, at least to me as a data nerd, is how the case per capita numbers are shaking out. So we've got a Google map attached to most of our stories that has one map with the raw numbers, cases, deaths, and tests, and one with the confirmed cases per capita. Because it's a little bit overwhelming to look at, you know, Marion or Hamilton or Johnson counties and try to compare those numbers to some of our smallest counties like Ohio or Warren or Union counties. But when you contextualize those numbers by population, there are some stark differences. So one of the things that I did was I broke down the data by cases per 10,000 residents. Marion County has about 47 cases per 10,000 residents. But then you compare them to the two largest per capita counties, which would be Decatur County, which is 68 cases per 10,000. And Cass County, which is 52.3 per 10,000 residents. So there's a lot of interesting contextualization that's going on because we do now have more data from the State Department of Health. But that's kind of where we're at as far as the numbers go.
And so we can see that Google map on some of our online stories on some of our affiliate websites?
Yeah, absolutely. Any of your Indiana Public Broadcasting stations, especially if they are publishing the daily wrap-ups that I have been doing every night for the last 33 days, or doesn't count for 33, but 33 weekdays. Yeah, the map is always involved in that. And basically any story that we have that touches even remotely on testing or kind of frequency of virus, we've got that included as well.
Okay. And the governor extended the state's stay-at-home order on Monday. What's new?
Yeah, so there's not a whole lot that's new. So the order itself mostly clarifies information on pet grooming and garden stores.
Wait, so what's the clarification? Do we know?
Oh, yeah. No, it's just basically reiterating that, yes, pet grooming can happen as long as you are respecting CDC guidelines. If you are like, there's a lot of veterinary offices that have been taking pets from folks in their vehicles, taking the pet, doing what they need to do for the animal, and then bringing it back. And so doing that kind of grooming and just making sure that, no, you're not allowed to have a groomer inside your home. They either have to have a setup in a vehicle outside of your home or something along those lines. And garden stores, just, yes, you can be a garden store and be open. Just make sure that you are able to control the number of people who are inside your store so that we can maintain that 6 feet of distance.
Okay.
But the biggest change, the big deal, is that there is a rolling back of restrictions on elective surgeries and procedures getting ready to start. Healthcare providers were ordered at the start of the month to either cancel or postpone non-urgent procedures in order to conserve supplies. But Holcomb says as numbers have improved, the state has spent the last week evaluating whether it's safe to allow those surgeries once more. So that official decision, air quotes decision, will be made on Sunday, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly from the stay-at-home order. So the state's figuring out essentially if we have the personal protective gear to supply our hospitals, we can start opening up these non-urgent procedures, and also pointing to things like optometrists, like abortion providers, and dentist office offices to allow them to start taking patients again.
And speaking of the governor, I want to get into the protests that happened at the governor's mansion over the weekend. But first of all, I guess what's going to happen next?
Yeah, so the plot twist is that we really don't know exactly. We do know that the governor had a deadline for business associations and other groups to provide feedback on how doable it is to for certain sectors of the economy to reopen while offering appropriate protections for both employees and consumers. We might hear more about that today. We might not until next week. Illinois and Michigan have extended their stay-at-home orders, but they've rolled back the restrictions while adding in a few new ones like wearing masks in public. So Illinois is extended through the end of May. Michigan, I believe, is May 15th. So we might see something similar to that, but we won't. The governor is not going to make that kind of decision until the end of next week.
And speaking of masks, we did see a few, or rather you did see a few at the governor's mansion last weekend. But for the most part, it looked like people were not wearing masks at the demonstration.
Yeah, about a third to a quarter of folks who were at that demonstration were wearing masks. I was covering as a one-woman band for radio and television. But there were easily 300 people crowded together along Meridian Street. Most of the folks that I talked to said the stay-at-home order didn't make sense to them in order to take care of folks who are sick. They needed to be able to work. They need to have some sort of income. But there were also a few folks that I spoke to who didn't believe in the severity of the virus or who pointed to unverified treatments as reasons to reopen everything immediately. So I'm very interested to hear your segment at the end of today's show because I can't wait to hear that.
That was, that was a very, very eye-opening study done out of Notre Dame. And we've got that coming up later in the show. Also, I understand that SideFX and Indiana Public Broadcasting are doing a Facebook Live.
Oh, we already did.
Oh.
If I sound exhausted, it's because I am. last night was a late one for your friendly neighborhood digital producer, but it was also energizing. So SideFX and IPB News partnered last night to compare and contrast some of the stay-at-home orders or lack thereof in the Midwest. So everyone's favorite Alabet Grumpy State House reporter Brandon Smith was a panelist, and so was Sebastian Martinez Valdivia from KBIA in Columbus, Missouri, and Iowa Public Radio's Natalie Krebs. So go check out that conversation. It was super interesting. As somebody who has spent way too much time reading Governor Holcomb's executive orders, I found it really illuminating and eye-opening to kind of see that comparison, that contrast. So go check it out on either SideFX Public Media's Facebook page or go to the Facebook page that I run, which is Indiana Public Broadcasting on Facebook. It really helped offer a ton of context, and I personally very much enjoyed it.
Excellent. I got the whole band together for that. And this week, House Democrats asked for additional protections for essential workers.
Yeah. So they sent a letter to Governor Holcomb to create enforcement guidelines to make sure businesses are protecting workers. So in his stay-at-home order on Monday, he included language that requires businesses to follow CDC guidelines, which includes masks and 6 feet of distance. And he's included that in previous stay-at-home orders as well, but did not put an enforcement mechanism in there. So House Democrats say it doesn't have any teeth to actually protect essential workers. The caucus is also asking the state to require personal protective equipment for essential workers, make it easier for them to get workers' compensation if they get infected. And the governor's office confirmed that they received the letter, but said there are no plans currently to make changes regarding safety enforcement policies.
All right. And on the business side, we got some grim numbers about the impact the virus is having on restaurants.
Yeah. So a recent National Restaurant Association survey reports about 2% of restaurants have had to permanently close as a result of the virus. And it estimates about $1 billion in losses for restaurants in the state.
Just in Indiana?
Just for Indiana and just for April.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
So Samantha Horton, the IPB News business reporter, talked with the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association president, and he said that federal aid from the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, not to be confused with PPE, has been scarce with very few actually receiving money in the state, which... On that particular note, Brandon Smith did a story about U.S. Senator Todd Young basically saying, hey, this program was designed specifically for small businesses. And so large businesses that got that money should be giving it back, and pointed to some publicly traded companies in Indiana like Sporting Goods Company, Escalade Inc., Emmis Communications, and Hallador Energy.
All right. And let's see. Oh, the Indiana 2022. Hey, we're still covering COVID-19?
We are still covering COVID-19, but we are also still covering the election. So the Facebook Live, actually, that we did is because of questions that we've received from everyone. You, the audience, the person listening to me.
Sure.
we're also putting together a voting guide to walk folks through how what you need to know ahead of the new voter registration deadline. And that's because of questions that we've received. So in order to join, text ELECTIONS to 73224 to join the Indiana 2022 way. We're covering COVID-19. We're answering those questions on the daily basis. But we're also still going to provide you the information that you need in order to focus on the election, including how different state departments are responding to COVID-19, all of those things. It all plays into what you do in the ballot box for the primary and for the November election as well.
All right. Lauren Chapman is Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, as always. Thank you, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, the scientific community wants you to go in your backyard this weekend and take a few pictures. The 2020 City Nature Challenge officially takes place in Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, and South Bend this weekend, but you can do it in other cities too. We'll tell you about that next. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. All In. I'm Matt Pelser. This weekend, urbanites across the country will engage in some citizen science. Now, this doesn't mean that they'll be violating any social distancing measures, not in the least. It's part of an annual urban biodiversity inventory that can help researchers in a variety of ways. It's the 2020 City Nature Challenge, and three Indiana cities are taking part. Here to talk with us about it is the executive director of the science communication nonprofit Indiana Sciences, Rufus Cochran. Good afternoon.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So I'm guessing you can probably explain it better than I just did. What is the 2020 City Nature Challenge?
Yeah, well, I think you did a great job, but I'll try and fill in a little bit. The City Nature Challenge is a challenge that actually started about 4 years ago between L.A. and San Francisco, their natural history museums, to see who could document the most urban wildlife in their cities. And that grew to about a dozen cities the year after that. And then in 2018, Indianapolis got involved with over 50 cities all across the country. We had a really cool turnout, over 200 citizen scientists making about 2,500 observations. And then last year, the challenge really blew up. Over 100 cities all across the world, and Indy was a big part of that with over like 300 people participating in Indy. And so this year, with over 250 cities, we're going to compete in the City Nature Challenge. And it's a really simple challenge. That's the really cool thing about it. All you have to do is put the iNaturalist app on your phone, install it, walk outside, simple enough, keep social distance, and then make an observation of any of the wildlife that you see. So it can be as simple as you look down at all that green stuff under your feet. Initially, when the first year I did this, I looked down and I said, okay, that's got to be all grass. Go to take a picture. The app helps you understand what species you're looking at. And I noticed there's some purple, there's some yellow, there's some green. And when you kind of get on your hands and knees and your hands a little dirty, you notice, oh man, there's violets down there. There's mustard down there. There's all these different ground covers that really have this huge richness of biodiversity that's hidden right under your feet. We walk past it every day and don't even realize it's there. So the whole root of the challenge is really just helping people get in contact and really reconnect with the wildlife right outside of their door, and then create that benchmark of the biodiversity for the city so that researchers and different groups can use that data to make better decisions.
If I want to participate, what do I do? You said you download the iNaturalist app, and then what do you do from there? You take pictures, say where you are, or does it collect that data on automatically?
Yeah, and that's a really cool part about this program is that by using the iNaturalist app, all you have to do is in the app, click that you're going to take a picture, make an observation, focus your camera on the squirrel that's running across your fence post, the bird that's on your bird feeder outside your window, or even just the plants that you have growing out in behind your house. And when you take that picture, what the app's going to do is give you suggestions on what it thinks that picture is of. And then when you click which thing you think it is, that'll make that observation and it'll geotag it with your location based off of your phone. And just for everybody, I know I'm always concerned about privacy. It anonymizes your data and gives you a location buffer. So it puts it in a general range that the observation is made, but nobody can take it back to where you are physically. So the app does the heavy lifting in the background, and all you have to do is really go out and experience the nature that's hiding in your backyard.
Because typically scientists don't really care exactly where it was. It's just kind of more of a region thing. Like, this was found around here.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really gives us a great sense of the biodiversity in an area and what that biodome actually looks like, the biome in that area. So yeah, the general area is enough for researchers. And the really neat thing too is you don't have to really stress about, oh, is this that specific type of beetle or is it that specific type of bird? There's a crowdsourcing function that's built into the program where naturalists and other people in the community and experts will come in and look at the observations and say, oh, I think that's actually this species or that species. And that kind of idea of the knowledge of the crowd, they will come in and add to your observation to make it more specific. And once a couple of people do that, your observations will actually become research grade, which is really cool because universities and governmental groups and nonprofits can come in and pull that data and make really actionable decisions on how they should be working to make a more sustainable community.
Oh, that's so cool. And so in 2018, Indy started participating in this. Were there big events that you held perhaps in the last 2 years that you can't hold this year around the City Nature Challenge?
Well, yeah. So one of the great things that we've been able to do is build up really awesome partnerships with Indiana DNR and Indy Parks. And a lot of the really, I think, undersung nonprofits here in Indy, they're doing a lot of work to raise awareness of the different environments and habitats that exist around the city and throughout the state, like Indiana Forest Alliance and the Indiana Wildlife Federation, reconnecting to our waterways. There's tons of really fantastic groups. And so over the last couple of years, through our partnerships, what we've been able to do is create really awesome events where people can go out to like Eagle Creek Park or to Broad Ripple Holiday Park, all the great state and city parks here in Indy, and get training and learn from the master naturalists that are at those parks, how to tell the difference between different types of trees, how to find, tell the difference between different types of mushrooms, lots of really cool training activities, a lot of really cool community and bonding in those groups. But this year, obviously, with the big challenge of not being able to have any events, what we had to figure out was, how can we still bring that sense of community to people? How can we still allow them to reconnect with the wonder of the natural world that we walk past so often without all of those really skilled and really valuable partner events and experts? And so what we've tried to do is set up a set of challenges each day, usually starting at noon, that allows people to participate on their own at a safe social distance, but still kind of have that sense of community. So the first one, they're Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So the first one is, we're asking students and teachers to take what we're calling a 15-minute backyard field trip. And I know a lot of people right now have been thrown into the fray. They realize how valuable and how huge of a service teachers give to our community. I think we can all agree, as soon as we get back to this, they all need to be paid double immediately. but what we're asking is, let those students get outside, get some energy out, and also do some citizen science in the process. So on Friday, we're saying run outside, take some observations, and if you're a teacher, give your students some extra credit, right? The good folks at Sustain Indy have reached out and talked to some different schools throughout the area, and we're really hoping that this is a cool opportunity for teachers and parents who are, by proxy teachers right now, to get the students an opportunity to go outside. And then on Saturday, our big event is on noon on Saturday. We want everybody throughout the state, this will be taking place in South Bend and Fort Wayne, as well as Indianapolis, 15 minutes of nature. And the challenge is, we just want everybody to walk outside, wave at their neighbor from a safe distance, let everybody know that we're all in this together, and that this community of Hoosiers are strong and resilient through all of this. And then get some sunlight, get some fresh air, make a couple of observations. And if you see any litter around, pick it up. Cause that's one of our really good partners from the beginning. This has been keeping Indianapolis beautiful, and they do a lot of amazing work to keep the city clean. And that's a big part of nature and conservation, as well as making sure we keep the city shining and spotless, And then the last one on Sunday, which really excited about Sunday, is a challenge to just go outside and take a 15-minute nature walk. And so go outside, take a walk with your kids, with your partner, with your best four-legged friend, whatever you call family. Go outside and spend some family time. And the city parks and the state parks are open. They're there for people to get exercise. Indy Parks has done a great job of communicating how to use the parks in a safe and responsible way. And we're just encouraging people to, it's tough being inside your house for, a long period of time, and fresh air and some sunlight is a great way to reduce stress and to kind of get regrounded and reconnected.
So on Friday, today is the 15-minute backyard field trip for parents and teachers. And then tomorrow is the 15 minutes of nature. And then Sunday is the 15-minute nature walk. And where can we find some of these directives?
Yeah, so you can find and follow us on all the social media at Indiana Sciences, or check it out on our website at indianasciences.org.
Okay. And I'm talking with the executive director of Indiana Sciences, Rufus Cochran, and we're talking about the City Nature Challenge 2020, which involves the iNaturalist app. And it's an inventory of urban biodiversity. And Indianapolis, South Bend, and Fort Wayne are three cities that are officially participating, although you can participate no matter where you are in Indiana, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's the another really cool thing about the project is the City Nature Challenge really acts as a catalyst, as a focused moment for people to go outside and engage with nature and this idea of citizen science. But you can do this all throughout the year. You can use the app anytime, and you don't have to be in a city that's competing in the challenge to participate. The challenge is just a way to really get people knowledgeable and engaged with the program. But outside of that, anybody can participate wherever they're at. And we really encourage that. I know more times than once I found a bug, you know, crawling around on the back patio that I've been just completely amazed by. And I'm wondering, what is that? And I remember, oh, I got this app, pull it out on my phone, take a picture, and realize, oh, it's this, you know, specific type of beetle from, you know, this genus. And it just really helps you connect and understand the natural world around you a little better, which I think is good for everybody, right?
Yeah. Well, I understand between the three cities, you mentioned, you said the word competition earlier. Mm-hmm. Is there going to be some competition between Indy and South Bend and Fort Wayne?
Yes. This? Yeah. And I, you know, with basketball, you know, down and baseball, not sure when it's going to restart. This is, I think, a great proxy. Everybody loves friendly competition. And I think this is a fun opportunity. We've had in the past rivalries with the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, which was fun. It was around the same time that the Pacers were playing the Cavs in the playoffs. So a lot of friendly banter back and forth between us. Mm-hmm. And this year, with the competition expanding in Indiana to South Bend and Fort Wayne, we've got a friendly rivalry and competition between the three cities going to see who can make the most observations and have the most observers. So,
what have you documented yourself like in years past? Have you been doing this since Indy started participating in 2018?
Yeah, I will tell you it. As someone who is new to the naturalist and conservation space, it has been an eye opener for me going through this. The first time my wife and I went out to one of the parks, I kind of mentioned before, I looked down and said, oh, okay, I'll take a picture of grass, and found so many different types of ground cover right underneath my feet. I was walking through one of the parks, tripped, not flatteringly, tripped right over a big log, right?
When is it ever?
Yeah. And I walked back and I realized that when that log had rolled over, there was literally a city of bugs and different things crawling and rolling around, really decomposing, building habitats inside of that old log that was there. And it's those little things hidden underneath that really just in my mind kind of just are an amazing sense of what all is right underneath us every day. And so my wife and I have a healthy competition to see who can make the most observations each year. And she admittedly usually beats me. but it's a ton of fun. I know one of the coolest things that I really enjoy doing is if you go out around dusk, a lot of the times you can find owls that are flying around and taking care of their business. And the other thing that's just, I think everybody is super familiar with how many squirrels there are in Indiana and Indianapolis. And I enjoy finding squirrels in all the different places that I go because they are very resourceful. They're really fast, and they're more challenging than you would think to get a really good picture of. And so that kind of photography challenge is something I really enjoy. So.
Well, and you mentioned South Bend too, and I've been to the Notre Dame campus, and those are some brave squirrels up there. You can get really close to them.
So yes, they are.
If you want to take input some squirrels into the database, by all means, go there. And so, I'm trying to get an idea, a sense of what researchers can do with this. So, say a researcher wants to conduct a study on the amphibian biodiversity of Fort Wayne, Indiana, mm-hmm. with the most up-to-date data they can get. So they could use what Fort Wayne residents input this weekend and just narrow it down and go, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the easiest, most relatable things that to give people a sense of how this data can be used is I know I've got a nice big sweet gum tree in the front of my house, and it's got the when we first moved in, these weird vines that are just all the way up it. And I didn't realize what it was, but it is a invasive species. It's one of the creeper families of vines. And as people go through all these different areas throughout the city, and they're taking pictures of all the different, you know, plants and bushes that they see, we can track all of the different invasive species and how widespread they are throughout the city and throughout the area. So it's a really good way to track that. And then to also know, have any new invasive species been brought into the area since the last year, so that hopefully we can see those sooner rather than later and try and remove those before they, you know, overrun areas.
This has been a wealth, and I can't wait to participate this weekend. I'll be downloading the app. Rufus Cochran is the executive director of the nonprofit Indiana Sciences, and they're partnering with Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, and South Bend for the 2020 City Nature Challenge. But you can still participate if you don't live in one of those cities. Just download the iNaturalist app. Rufus, thank you so much for letting us know about this.
Matt, it was an absolute pleasure, and thanks for letting us share.
Up next, have you seen the photos from last weekend? Demonstrators gathering in front of state houses, government buildings, the governor's mansion in the case of Indiana, protesting the closure of the economy due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, a Notre Dame professor is co-author of a new study that suggests that political polarization causes some people to resist practicing safe guidelines like social distancing and avoiding non-essential trips, among others. Some of the things she found were pretty surprising. We'll hear how she conducted the study and some of her conclusions next. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Last weekend saw a number of demonstrations across the country protesting the closure of the economy due to the COVID-19 pandemic, including one here in Indianapolis at the governor's mansion. And while many of these demonstrations were in direct violation of stay-at-home or shelter-in-place orders, which are still in effect across the country, there are plenty of people who didn't go for obvious reasons, but who share the sentiments of those who did. Now, setting aside the conspiracy theories that drove some people out to those demonstrations, it's easy to understand everyone else's frustrations. People are out of work. People are concerned about the broader economy. But there are also a lot of people at all stages of the political spectrum who simply don't trust the government, local, state, or federal, on what we're being made to do to slow the spread of coronavirus. My guest today is assistant professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame and co-author of a new study that shows people who identify with the political party that's not in charge of their state are less likely to observe social distancing measures. Kirsten Cornelson, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
So, as I mentioned, your study came out at just the right time. When you heard about last weekend's demonstrations, I don't know, were you surprised?
I mean, I wasn't. I mean, I'm surprised in the sense that I think we've all been surprised since the beginning of this. You know, we wouldn't. I don't think I would have predicted ahead of time that, you know, these measures to reduce the spread of a major pandemic would be so controversial. So, in that sense, I think, you know, my mind is still back in January before we realized that this was going to be so controversial.
I want to get into some of the data that you looked at and your analysis of that data. But if you could distill the main point of your study, I guess the main conclusion, what would it be?
I mean, the main conclusion is, you know, as you mentioned, what we show is that people who live in the state where the other party is in charge are less likely to comply with recommended measures like washing your hands or staying away from high risk friends and family, things like that. And I think the key message or the reason that finding is important is that it points to a degree of what we call social fragmentation, right? That we're a bit worried that we are increasingly becoming divided on the basis of our political orientation and that this is hurting our ability to really come together as a community to fight things like COVID-19. And what this suggests is that this seems to be true, right? Just having, you know, when you see that your state's governor is from the other party, you're less likely to comply with their recommendations.
And so when we hear something like that, obviously it applies to this moment directly, and that's great. But to what other parts of society could that apply to, or other times, other things?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually an issue that's been recognized in economics in a variety of contexts for a long time, right? So a lot of economic activity is based on what we call public goods, right? So you think about things like the road system or the public education system, right? So these are things that the government provides for free to everybody, and they really underpin a lot of our productivity as a society, right? We wouldn't be able to get much done if we didn't have a highway network. We'd be certainly much less productive if we didn't have a decent public education system. But crucially, the ability to provide these things relies on individuals' willingness to vote to pay for them, right? We have to go to the polls and say, yes, I'm willing to pay higher taxes to support this public education system or this road system. And, you know, we only reap a very small part of the benefits of these things ourselves, right? You know, we pay our taxes, but we only get a tiny fraction of the benefits of these systems. Our willingness to do that depends crucially on how much we identify with or empathize with other people in our society. And so other economists have studied this problem, for example, in societies that are very ethnically fragmented, right? So where there's a high degree of tension across different ethnic groups. And they show that societies where this is true do seem to have a harder time providing these kinds of public goods. And so we think this is very much a similar story, right? We're increasingly becoming divided along political lines instead of ethnic lines. And this is hurting our willingness to contribute to the public good, which in this case means staying home.
What kind of things did you ask the sample for your study, this one?
So we asked them things like, have you left the house in the past 48 hours? And if so, why? Right. So we wanted to try and look at non-essential travel, right? So whether people were leaving the home for reasons other than work or to, say, go to the doctor. We asked them about a series of things they might be, you know, whether they were doing certain things more often over the past 2 weeks than they normally did. So things like washing your hands, wearing a mask or protective gear out in public, you know, staying home from work, those kinds of things. And of course, we also asked them about their political orientation.
Oh, of course. And your study utilized a sample of over 1,000 people from 12 states, which were carefully chosen. Why did you choose the states that you chose?
Well, we really wanted to make sure we were comparing apples to apples in some sense. You know, so if I told you that, you know, Democrats in Texas or Republicans in California complied less with social distancing measures, you know, you might say something like, well, those people, they're a bit, you know, different, right? They're just almost by construction. They're political minorities in these states where almost everyone agrees on the other party. So maybe this is just a reflection of their personality, right? That they're just people who are a bit contrarian. This doesn't actually have anything to do with the fact that the other party's in charge. And so what we wanted to do was to say, compare Republicans who are in states where the Republican just barely won to Republicans in states where the Republican just barely lost. And so those two people are, you know, in fairly similar overall environments. And so we think it's more of a valid comparison between them.
I think an important thing to note here is that when you see photos from this past weekend's protest, and again, you didn't look at that for your study, but I think it's worth mentioning, it's easy to notice all the Trump supporters, but your study found that in the Republican states you surveyed, where the Republican governor won by a slim margin, both Republicans and Democrats reported leaving home more often for non-essential travel, but the difference was larger for Democrats in those states where the Republican governor won by a margin. What does that tell us?
Well, and that there is this, you know, a lot of other work has been highlighting the fact that Republicans do in general seem to comply less with social distancing measures. The story we're telling is a bit more nuanced, right? It says, you know, yes, this is true that Republicans do comply less, but that even Democrats are susceptible to this kind of effect of being less willing to comply when they identify less with the person in charge.
Aha. Uh-huh. So why are we assuming that states with close elections might be more politically polarized? It seems like you're right. And I would guess that you're right, even if I hadn't read the study. And maybe that's why you chose to look at it this way. But is that based on previous data, or is that your own conclusion after running these numbers that in states where the governor's won by a margin, you might be more polarized?
It's actually not necessarily the case that the close states are more polarized. We didn't choose them for that reason. We just chose them so that we could make a valid comparison between, you know, people who were in kind of similar environments, uh-huh. Right? We think there's not much difference between a state where the Republican just barely won and one where they just barely lost. When we actually looked at how the effects differed by the level of political polarization, we ran our analysis using the entire set of 50 states, right? So we also did a sample of people from states with, you know, from all of the states. And what we found was that this effect of having an opposite party governor was bigger in states that were more polarized. Right. So it's not that the close states themselves are more polarized, but that the effect does seem to be bigger in the more polarized states.
How did you measure the political spectrum in your study?
So we went back to the 2016 American National Election Studies. So around every midterm and presidential election, there's a group of researchers who do these opinion polls of Americans, and they ask questions like, you know, on a scale of 0 to 100, how warmly do you feel towards each party? And so that those questions have been used by us and by other researchers to measure what's called effective polarization, or the degree of hostility towards the other party. So basically, it's the difference between how warmly you feel towards your own party versus how warmly you feel towards the other party. And so that's the way we're defining political polarization, or how we're trying to capture hostility.
And so when you look at that scale, what then on that scale did you determine to be the extremes? What were your marks?
Yeah, so the average across states, if you look at the difference between how warmly you feel towards your own party and the other party, the average difference is around 40. Right. Okay. So there's about a 40-point difference. So you could think of this as being, I forget the exact averages, but it's something like you have a degree of warmth of about 70 towards your own party and about 30 towards the other party. And so the range there, it's not huge. I think it's most of the states are kind of between 30 and 50. So that's the kind of degree of difference you should be thinking about.
We are talking with Assistant Professor of Economics from the University of Notre Dame, Kirsten Cornelson, who is the author of a new study about political polarization and whether or not that affects people's compliance to COVID-19 restrictions in their states. Now, we're talking about political polarization, but did you find anything interesting about people with more moderate points of view?
We did, actually. So, you know, we showed that the effect was biggest in states that were more polarized, but we also asked our individual respondents about how hostile they were towards the other party and broke the results down that way. And we were really surprised by what we found, which was that the effect was really driven by the more moderate people in our sample. And that's moderate whether you measure it in terms of hostility or just ask them kind of on a scale of 0 to 6 how left or right wing you are. It's people right in the center that show the biggest shift when another party governor is elected. Hmm. And so that was a bit surprising given what we showed at the state level, right, that the more polarized states are the ones that show the biggest effect. And the way we think we can reconcile those two results is that we think maybe what's going on is that it's not so much your own hostility towards the other party that matters here. It's your perceptions of the other party's hostility towards you, right? So it's not people themselves who are hostile that are showing this effect. It's people who live in an environment that is hostile. And so we thought that was a really interesting nuance in our results.
Yeah, that hostility begets hostility, essentially?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, it's not hostility as measured. You know, again, these are people who themselves didn't express any hostility, but you could certainly interpret their behavior as reflecting a type of hostility, right? An unwillingness to kind of chip in.
How, again, did you measure or determine hostility?
So we use the same scale as in the ANES. So we asked people to rate their degree of warmth towards the other party and towards their own party and took the difference.
I mean, we see this kind of tone every day on social media, and it seems like so much of it's not about, as you said, how right one side is, but how wrong the other side is. That's very much
That's a part of it,
it seems like.
That's right. And I think Ezra Klein has, and he's got a new book out about polarization that I recently read and that I quite liked. And he calls this negative partisanship, right? It's not so much that we are so attached to our own parties. It's that we are really hostile towards the other party. And that seems to be what's driving a lot of the increased polarization.
And what are some of the societal problems that can come from that? I mean, aside from the obvious, it seems like when you look at it this way, political polarization can really get in the way of societal cooperation. We have a common goal right now, slow down the virus. But if we don't believe the people in power simply because of their political stance, even if what they're stating is fact, how can we cooperate? How much does that question come into play here?
I mean, that's exactly the question that we we're interested in answering. And I think, you know, you're exactly right that that ability to cooperate really underpins so much of what we can accomplish as a society. And it's just really being thrown into sharp relief by this crisis that we're in the middle of.
So here we are, less than a month and a half from what many have pointed to as the nationwide turning point, mid-March. That means that you must have been busy getting this together. What was your turnaround for this study?
It was fast. The beautiful thing about work, we ran our survey through a platform called MTurk, where you find workers who are willing to do these surveys online through Amazon. And, you know, you can put up a survey and get it answered usually within a day or two. And so we came up with this. We had to get it through the ethics board at Notre Dame. So that was about a week. And then within 2 days, we had the data. And a week later, we'd analyzed it and sent it out.
Wow. It seems like we learn something new, though, every day about this virus and what it does to people. Is there anything we know now that we didn't know when you were putting this together that might have changed how your sample may have felt?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing that's probably changed is people's perception of risk to themselves in some ways. You know, when we were running this survey, the virus was still very much being portrayed as something that was primarily a threat to older people and to people who were immunocompromised. And so for most of the people in our sample, staying home or washing your hands, you know, these are, by the way, the people in our survey kind of skew young because they're people who are answering surveys online. So these were young people who, you know, we would think are, you know, at the time would not necessarily have perceived that they themselves had a high risk from leaving the house or from, you know, of being seriously affected by the virus. And so their decisions to do these things really were reflections of altruism, I think, more than self-interest. Whereas, right now, I'm not sure that you'd see the same result simply because people, I think, are the ones who are staying home are doing so, at least in part, more to protect themselves, as we've begun to understand that the virus really is dangerous for everybody or is potentially dangerous for everybody.
Had you been planning to look at political polarization maybe through some other lens and you decided to shift gears and study this moment instead?
Yeah, I mean, I'd already been working on a different paper on political polarization. That one was about the question of whether, you know, if we talk to people who are different from us on the political scale, whether we can come together a bit more in our political views. I wanted to think a bit about how we might go about addressing polarization. And so I was kind of in the middle of working on that project when this virus hit. Part of what made me think of it was that I had actually a bunch of pre-existing data on political polarization that I'd gathered before the crisis. And we used that in some of our results just to make sure, you know, to look at things like whether the crisis increased polarization itself, questions like that.
Hmm. Well, and what does that data go back even further? I mean, what do we know about how people felt decades ago versus now?
We know that polarization has definitely been increasing. So there's a nice paper by Matt Jenskow, who is another economist who works in this area. And he gathers data from multiple different countries and goes back as far as he can in each country. And in the U.S., he shows that this measure of hostility that I mentioned has been increasing since at least 1980. You know, so there are some other measures of hostility where we don't study them as much because we don't have as much data on them. But if you look at things like you ask people whether they would be upset if their son or daughter married someone from the other party. You know, there are surveys that ask people that in 1965 and then again in 2010. And that fraction went from about, I think it was like 5% in the 1960s to over 20% now, right? Wow. So there are some other measures where we can go back even further. And we know that these things have been increasing over time.
I'm curious, why are you a professor of economics looking at political polarization?
Well, you know, a lot of what leads to good economic outcomes, I think, depends on us having functional social systems as well, social and political systems as well. Certainly, you know, as I mentioned, a lot of the economy does rely on things like cooperation and the ability to provide public goods. This is something economists have recognized for a very long time. And I'm just personally quite concerned that our political polarization is getting to the point where it's undermining our ability to provide those kinds of goods.
Kirsten Kornelson is Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of Notre Dame and the author of Political Polarization, Social Fragmentation, and Cooperation During a Pandemic, a new study. Kirsten, thanks for this work, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and one of the only people manning the building right now. Thanks for that, Adam. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can get it wherever you get podcasts. Subscribe so you always know what we're up to. Catch up if you have a little extra time. We are on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana, and you can follow us there so you know what we're going to cover before we cover it. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.